including the internet, should support both kind of systems, both the resource planning and the actual control systems running the tools. But in practice, this is very challenging. And that's partly or mostly what Industry 4.0 is all about. And we'll get back to this.
So, some of it is in the cloud and some of it is out of the cloud. Maybe some of it is more clear than others. Make your own guess of what this shows. Okay, so information technology, what is it?
Technical reference on hardware specifications, data storage, processing data. This is the IT. It's probably the most important abbreviation, apart from information systems in this course.
Okay, but it's also about the
hardware, the infrastructure, and it's knowing enough about both the software available and how you make your own software maybe, and also how you pick both software and hardware. That's kind of the trick these days to run a business. It's getting the right software and the right tools, knowing what will be coming, and that used to be the main point of the course, and it still is, actually. So you, as master's students, you should be able to have some more tools to choose and maybe design your own system, software or hardware and manufacturing systems. The architecture of what you build is something you'll know something about in this course, at least at a high level.
And then you'll get more training later. So, but an information system
is much more than just the information technology. As you can read here.
And you know some of it, I guess. Okay, it includes the human factor. And that means,
I guess I mentioned it in the part one also, that at least 50% of any information system is the human user. And what that means. So that's why this slow and painful comes in also. So a computer system which doesn't really fit the needs of the user is a problem all over the place. And we'll get back to that.
So an information system can be seen as social action where interaction, negotiation, interpretation, and rationalization are practiced in synergy with IT in an organizational context.
It's a mouthful to kind of, and also take some time to grasp all this, but that's what information systems is all about. And I mentioned a slide last time also, a tool called TOGAF, which is the Open Group Architectural Framework, which I know, and which helps architects design systems and enterprises to work with the information technology. And that's, there are many tools, and you'll know more of them
in due course. So as you can imagine,
any system will affect the user, and how you design it will also. This is something which is much more known now than it used to be. So this is what some of the books, like this book by Clark, who used to be a consultant, he mentions many classic examples of, and many you know also. And the news is often, especially in Norway, it's full of news on. Say more or less failed IT projects all over the place, especially when the systems become complex, such as hospitals. Any kind of enterprise where there are a lot of users and maybe not the full overview, then the IT also becomes very complex. So schools and universities, another good example. So,
So last time or last year, I also brought a book.
I, bar- I lent it to someone, so I didn't get it back yet, but there's a book in Norwegian called Lodditsystem, which is a good Norwegian title, the first Norwegian words. That's what a typical user would say about most IT systems, in especially the hospital sector. So it's written by consultants. I recommend it. That's where you end up if you're really stressed. You kind of fight the system and you find ways around it.
Yeah, this is. So these assumptions.
Any thoughts of these assumptions? Any additional assumptions you'd like to add? So, assumptions are what we imagine about something without necessarily knowing. I guess that's maybe the best definition. But also, the more you know about something, the better assumptions you can make. But it's kind of a fairly good overview of the things I've been talking about a bit. So the final point, there is a need for an information system strategy. That's the motivation for knowing more about strategy. So you have to have a plan in order to know anything. So your most important strategy now is to become finished with a master degree. That's the plan. In about a year, you're going to start the master's thesis. So, yeah, that's the plan.
Okay, on this
point, so manufacturing systems are socio-technical systems. Quite complex, but it's about more or less the same that I was talking about. I mean, it's a machine, it's information technology, but it's also the users involved and the supervisors or the systems telling everyone what to do, or the customers are also more or less involved. So the definition of the system becomes quite complex, and that's partly or mostly what this whole book by Clark is about. He presents theory and knowledge, and he ends up with quite complex figures trying to show everything, how everything fits together. But it doesn't really make sense unless you've studied most of the book. But we'll help you with this.
So, anybody studied social science before? This is, yeah?
At least it was part of social science. It was a course called Innovation Management in Outgoing Markets or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yeah.
So it was a social science course, but it was only one in the degree I had.
Mm. Yeah.
I didn't do psychology or anything.
No. But economics is also mostly a social science. But it's a matter of definition.
Finance, is that like social science?
Finance is maybe the least social, I'd say.
That, yeah.
But yeah, it depends who you talk to. I think it's still on really the human part of business, but it's then quite technical compared to many other parts of.
Yeah.
And it's also the first. I guess one of the major leaders in artificial intelligence is the finance robots running the stock market of some places. You know. Much quicker to have a robot do the transactions by milliseconds than waiting for some trader to try to sell and buy things. But you get into interesting problems when things go this fast.
Now, Fox also around the world. Funds, like this financial funds. I think that's also
yeah, good
market.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a blurring line now because artificial intelligence and machine, or what it's called, decision support systems are now becoming very common. So then some places you can allow the robots to do their own trading, for instance, or within strict rules, but then there's some blurred line going between providing data to support the decision and actually making just following a simple rule. Some interesting, these are very interesting times for studying these things. There's a lot of stuff happening. And I think you guys can come up with good examples just from the internet or following some blog or something. I'm trying to follow some, but it's really hard to follow them all. We'll get back to this.
Okay, so one model of a socio-technical system. I won't spend too much time looking at this, but if you have kind of the social subsystem part, it's connected to the more technical infrastructure part. And what you define to be the material part or the hardware part, and what is the software system part, that's a matter of definition, but it's a typical kind of model from the social science side, because many of the theories and many of the this word, I don't actually use it ever myself either. Imbrication. How do you? I guess it has to do with realization or understanding. You should look it up yourself to see if you can understand the word. There are a lot of definitions, especially in social science, because there's not a lot of concrete or real stuff to handle, so you have a lot of definitions. And you have to make sure that you follow the right theory or you get in trouble. It's one of the reasons why I prefer technical stuff. But this is part of the background in the course, to have an understanding at least of the human side of understanding.
And in businesses, I guess people are 50-50 technical or human-oriented, especially in economics and management. As you know, you've had a management course already. A lot of the stuff there is very human-oriented, if you just know what you're looking for. Okay, and how does an information strategy and an IT strategy fit? One way of looking at it is, the IT is more kind of bottom-up. It's about the tools and the people who are going to actually execute orders, for instance. It's about getting things, technical systems, and actually getting the hard work done. While the information or system or strategy is more management level. It has to look ahead into maybe 5 years ahead or at least the next quarter. Well, the IT system has to work in more or less real time. And this is one of the splits. Okay?
We'll see more of this. Okay.
Yet another model system. So what is an information system strategy? What does it look like? What kind of boundaries do you set for your system or your enterprise? And who are you, and how do you interact with competitors and also the IT system? And it's about learning. There's some kind of learning activity here, like a typical interactive learning model. So you have to start doing something before you can improve what you're doing and actually know what you're doing. You have to start somewhere, and it's difficult to say what starts where and what is what, but this is part of strategy work. And Galliers is a book which is not used anymore, but it's another way of showing this. And Toga, for instance, have their own views of how to structure this.
Okay, but here's a definition for you. So strategic planning of information systems is an interactive learning process for the creation of strategy for business process redesign and development incorporating information technology. The strategy presents plans for information systems design, implementation, and operation for this purpose. Information systems strategy should bring competitive advantage or result in a competitive edge.
So that's the main driving force. I guess you guys could come up with some better, easier way of saying that you want to make. You have to fix something, whatever you're doing, how you study, for instance, in order to improve. That gives you the competitive advantage, or your even for your own self-improvement, which is even better than worrying about competitors. So this is from, for instance, people doing sports. They know that they have to improve every year, because, or else they, even though you win everything one year, you will probably won't win everything unless you improve even more next year. And same thing is happening in business and in manufacturing. So every year you have to improve by 5% maybe, or 10% from the deadlines, or cost of everything. So that makes it quite stressful, but also you have to be in the learning cycle for everything. It's really, it's a big challenge.
Okay, so there is an example here from real work.
John Markinson, he also published a paper on this, I know. I've worked with him on process monitoring sensors also. But this example is better because it shows kind of what happens when you introduce something made to improve a tool. So introducing sensors, which is what Industry 4.0 is partly about, and then understanding how those can be used. So what
this example is introducing a force
sensor or two in a machine tool made for cutting pieces. One of the most common tools in the machining enterprise is how you you cut metal to make parts, right? Forming it.
But as you know, there's actually a running cutting tool which gets worn, so you have to somehow figure out when to change this the knife.
And that's one of the things you can always improve. So, one figure, you can spend a couple minutes on this. So, in any manufacturing, you're making parts, you want to optimize the use of your equipment, increase the productivity. So, you have there's a hierarchy of control systems in any manufacturing plant or any kind of system. So where you have, especially when you put on sensors and have some objective sensor data in addition to the expert or the processor running the tool, then you have a control system which is fairly close to the knowledge in the line producing your parts. At a slightly higher level, you have some kind of maintenance system which monitors all the tools maybe in your production facility, which then has maybe a higher level of knowledge compared to just a single tool, because you know a bit more about this tool if you have 10 other tools like it. And then you have some way of connecting knowledge from more sources. And this is also partly what Industry 4.0 is about. It would be much better for everyone if you have access to maybe 1,000 tools, at least virtually, because you only have one or maybe 10 tools, and you don't know the typical statistics until you've been running it for a long time. So at a higher, even higher level, you have this manufacturing planning and control, and that's where this SAP and enterprise resource planning comes in. And there's this connection is much less automated, and it's quite removed from the actual tool here. So the managers trying to figure out how many people should run this tool or machine, they get quite removed from the actual process. And at an even higher level or abstraction is where the directors or the management tries to make decisions on investing in a new tool, for instance, or hiring more people, or cutting down on the number of employees, depending on how well everything is going. So the idea of Industry 4.0 is partly connecting these both ways, and it's an open question if the guys or women doing the actual processing work, are they gaining more knowledge and actually becoming more in control? Or is it the top management who think that they know what they're doing here because they have statistic tools or some other decision support system? So these things go both ways, and it's an interesting time for this. Because the hierarchy of any manufacturing facility is now being broken down more or less. Because you don't have enough people actually, because you can't afford to have two or three people for everything anymore. You have to make the most of what you have, and that's what these numbers are all about. So the typical thing is that any industry now has a lot. I mean, the productivity is so much improved that it's maybe a factor of three or four just in 15 years, for instance, at Raufoss, for typical production. There are a lot of numbers depending on who you ask, but that's the typical number in many industries. And that means you have maybe the same amount of people, but they produce four times as many parts. And maybe with four times as high quality, and they have to improve by 5% next year.
It's like that's the typical part of sustainable development.
Yeah. So that's an extra dimension: sustainability and finance, quality, and production. And you have to have enough people to make everything run. So this is still a critical part of any manufacturing facility. And that's where the learning part comes in also, because you have a trade-off between how much you can program in a computer, for instance, or a robot, and how much you have to reconfigure already next week. So that's one of the big trade-offs. You can't spend too much time programming robots, because you have to change everything next week, or at least next year. So that's one of the big challenges.
But that was a lot of the background. So the basic hypothesis in this work of introducing a force sensor was that the change in the tool condition will lead to a change in the measured force, which just seemed like a reasonable assumption. And just what kind of measurement you would be able to do was up to where you placed the sensor, for instance, and not the quality of the sensor, it could also be a few of the unknowns of the machine. Operators need high degree of process knowledge in order to analyze the fault detection situation. So that was assumed or known even before. Can't really just say that if the force is so and so, then you have to change the tool. So they are indirect in this setup. So even though a tool might be indicated as faulty, it's not necessarily a change that has to be done. You have to understand the process first.
Assumptions on the background here. I won't go too much
into this. You've seen most of it. But false alarms is one of the big worries.
Any new sensor system is not very popular. If you have a running machine which runs okay, then the false alarms are really very unwanted.
Okay, so
here's a flow chart showing the cutting process has some physical quantities, and they will then control what kind of sensor output you get or signal, and how you do the signal processing will also make it more or less likely that you will discover the errors or the new information in this signal. So this is a big part of any sensor system. You have to get the right amount of data at the right quality, and that's a big trade-off usually. And then based on the signal that you can read, maybe by just looking at a graph or processed by a machine learning algorithm, you make it some diagnosis of what's happening, and then this results in some action, and that will feed back into the process. And that's a feedback which can be a big disaster if you do the wrong stuff. So if you start reading data which is not the right data, then you're in trouble. Okay.
Can you see this?
It's not easy to see, but it's typical. Just tries to indicate two places on this machine I'm doing cutting, where to place it. So they use two sensors, which is always better than just one, especially if you don't really know what's the best place to place a sensor. But that's a big field in itself. How many sensors should you use?
They use two sensors for the same tasks?
Basically, you're trying to, try to measure the force indirectly using two separate sensors. That was, as far as I can remember, that was the main thing. So then you get an idea of the signal-to-noise ratio, for instance.
What exactly do you measure?
The force.
Yeah, but indirectly, you said.
Yeah.
What did they measure directly?
Because as far as I know, if you have a cutting tool running into a metal, you would like to measure the force at the cutting. But since you don't place the sensor inside of the actual cutting tool, then it's connected to something which is connected to the actual knife or the cutting tool. And I didn't do this myself, so I can't really say much more. But it's not inside the main cutting area, so it's indirectly. So it could be an accelerometer also. You could measure just vibrations. That's another possibility.
So if you have like an angle grinder, you put it in the axle of the angle grinder.
Or the best thing is to have the force sensor actually as a part of the tool.
Yeah.
But then you have to design the tool around the sensor, or at least include it from the design. And that's a big challenge. Introducing sensors after you've designed something is that you don't have access to maybe the most important things, or you have to worry about just the function and the survivability of the tool. Yeah.
There has been the sensors that has been designed as a functional part, like in the windmill, the bolts.
Yeah. Yeah, that work is ongoing to try to develop, but it's this project called this Dokka Fasteners, which some of our colleagues are working on this right now, but right now they don't know what the sensors will look like. So it's a typical example of a challenge where you want to introduce sensors without degrading the actual thing you're measuring. So in any critical tool part, for instance, or any critical material, you usually have to have 100% structural integrity. So if you try to put in a sensor or drill a part for something, then you reduce the strength typically, or introduce a weakness point for corrosion. There are a lot of challenges.
But it's a very interesting thing. And hopefully we'll get more news this spring on this project.
Okay, so after they put in these sensors and they did what they could, they had a few experiences. So, not surprisingly, there were a lot of false alarms, and some of the operators really didn't like this at all. They didn't really understand why these sensors were there. It didn't look helpful to them. So they did partial training for some of the operators, but not for everyone. And there are a lot of interesting learning points on the human side. So how do you learn something without affecting the whole process? This is really a challenge.
So, for instance, there were large differences
depending on what cutting tool you were using. So the forces really depend on both the metal that we are machining, but also the actual tool that we're using. So when you're changing between different kind of tools, then you get really different results. Not completely surprising either. And one of the things that was obvious was that the sensor position was not optimum. So you, this could always be improved. And that's back to this learning cycle. So if you try to design a system, you should always think about the version 2. When you should try to learn something from a prototype to improve the main design. That's good practice in design.
Hopefully just accept the change, adding more sensors, but by learning few of the operators, all of them accept it or not?
No, that's a good question. Probably just one or two were actually involved, and the rest were kind of lukewarm to the whole idea, I guess. So they started doing things.
So they started fooling the monitoring system
just to work around the whole sensor. These alarms were a bug, so they just changed the settings of the tool so that the alarms wouldn't go off. So if you have a working range with the highest and lowest force allowable, you just set those limits very wide and then you didn't get alarms. So, but then they didn't really learn anything.
So, how do you exchange information?
Also, not just from the sensors or in the system, but also to include the workers and the supervisors involved. So then they developed this system of a mentor or an expert and the usual user. And this is something we use also at Syntef. For every tool, there is a super user who really knows the tool very well and can also develop processes and understands the theory behind most of the tool work. And then there are more people who can just run the tool but don't really understand if something unexpected happens. So this is a good practice all over. And then you need this learning cycle for every tool, for every process running. So the best thing is to have more than one expert, or especially more than one mentor.
Because this mentor role is really...
It has to be an expert on this particular tool or system. And to have a mentor role, to be able to teach someone, you should be able to share knowledge. Don't worry about other people also getting the same knowledge that you have. That's some places very difficult. But some experts, they like to be the expert. They don't necessarily tell you about all the tricks. So the mentor was given both special training in the monitoring system as well as a systematic training for being a trainer and sharing knowledge. I don't know what's most difficult. So sharing knowledge is someplace that's a problem. But this is something which is kind of an assumption for Industry 4.0. You have to share knowledge all the time or else you just can't follow the speed of development, because no one can make all the mistakes themselves. You have to learn from each other. Because things are happening so fast. So
being able to see things from an abstract level, that's not for everyone either. Not all operators are interested in learning about the physics of the machine, for instance, or the material science of the material.
So, yeah, but that's the idea, to get everyone at least interested to learn more. That's the best. And that's what the industry at Atos is very good at, actually. So they invest almost they invest more time and money on the basic operators than the experts or the trained master's students, for instance. Which is interesting. This figure just shows that there is a mix between the informal learning and the formal learning. So studying at a university is kind of a mix, but the operators training is typically very formal. You have to have a structured 2-week course in order to get a certification to run this machine, for instance, or maybe it's just a 2-hour course, I don't know, depending on how complex it is. But in order to become a real expert and solve problems, you have to, you go a lot further than the basic training to understand the tool. And that's, the more expert you become, the more informal the learning becomes also. And that's where communication and the human part really comes in also. Because you can't possibly make everything formal. You can't make procedures every year to catch up on all the unknown knowledge that you learned just last semester, for instance. This is a big challenge.
So the definition of an expert is,
another definition is someone who's made all the mistakes. At least it used to be that way. Now it's maybe using also decision support system tools like simulation or modeling to understand things maybe before you do stuff. That's part of Industry 4.0. But it's making decisions autonomously, so you are the one as an expert to make reconfigurations, and you don't necessarily ask anybody else before you reconfigure. That makes you also the tool owner and the process owner. Then it becomes your responsibility to optimize the whole process.
Goes beyond the simple thing of not making mistakes. It's more improving all the time. So problem solving is a key success factor.
So root cause detection and elimination. And a lot of this stuff goes into this zero defect manufacturing course. That's a lot about quality control and systems that are around to help operators and experts to make the right decisions, like statistics. Statistical process control is one of the still basic tools. Setting the right low and high limits of the force sensor, that's statistical process control.
And a scientific approach. So plan before you do something, for instance, and try to learn from whatever you do. Yeah.
That's all over the place, and that's a basic thing in lean manufacturing and the scientific method also, and any learning cycle. Great.
So what is strategy?
So typically it's the top down. So people doing strategy work are typically management. So like you guys, when you finish the master's thesis, typically that would be some kind of management work. At least that's the way it used to be. Now it's maybe you become an expert of a subsystem instead of being a manager. But that's at least in the old days when people had a civil engineering degree in Norway, then you both become the technical expert, then suddenly also tend to become the management, especially in a small company, and especially if you make your own company. So then strategy is what do you plan. So the smaller the company, the easier it is to make a strategy. That's another learning point. So if you have a big company, then the strategy work becomes, it needs to involve a lot of people and a lot of complex communication. So the idea of making a strategy deliberately, that's
that's one school, like in the paper you read. This is just maybe not, that's not what really happens.
In reality, the management tends to not be as up to date as the maybe the engineers running the IT department or the actual people selling or servicing equipment, for instance. They know more about what the strategy should be, maybe. So in this example from the automotive industry, at least, that how to include the strategy for including. What was the example in this paper again? Do you remember?
No.
Okay.
Cutting the lines.
Yeah, it was in the automotive industry. There are a lot of examples, but it's all about what kind of technology are you going to introduce, and what do you think will arrive. But I think in reality, most strategy is kind of more a pattern than actually something that's a big plan. So there's a mix. That's the main learning point from this. This theory was developed by a guy called Mintzberg in the 80s. It's still relevant. So there's this intended strategy which tends to affect how everyone is thinking and working. And something else happens that makes the strategy the real strategy. That's observable for someone on the outside, for instance. And if you ask the manager or the director what is the strategy, it's not necessarily the actual strategy.
So strategy is usually emerging somehow. So
one question for a class, something you could, I've touched on it before, but what happens if you have some IT system where the IT is not, you can't fix the system, so you have to just do a workaround. That's one of the answers, right? What happens if the information system and organization is more flexible than the IT architecture, then tend to reorganize the whole enterprise around, for instance, the SAP, because you no one is able to fix the software, so then you just reorganize around software. That's what's happening around, actually, which is an interesting effect. So instead of getting the IT system you want, you will just buy what is available and reorganize. But it's part of manufacturing also, I think.
Okay. Won't do many more slides now, but
most important for next this week, you should read the first three chapters in Gilchrist's book, and two of you should prepare a 15-minute presentation, which we could share in class or on the blackboard directly. Any two volunteers?
Three chapters.
It's about the introduction to Industry 4.0. It's something you can read before going to sleep. It's not really complex. No, basically,
I have a question about this. I don't really understand. It must be recorded on some kind of webcam.
It's the best if you record it just using the sound, actually, microphone.
Just presentation and sound.
Yeah, that's the easiest. Or if you do a video, that's also fine, but it's more work. So.
You can try.
Yeah.
I will try.
Yeah.
Write me somewhere.
But the main challenge is that I want two of you to work together as a group.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes a slightly different process.
So I'm waiting for another volunteer.
Anyone wants to help Sasha with this first assignment?
Yeah.
you guys, or should I just post it on the back?
We can speak one language.
That's just don't go to war.
Well, that was not about people.
No, I know. No, it's.
That's not a humor. I like that.
It's a big thing. We have actually all of our PhD students are from Ukraine now.
All of them.
So we, all except one? No, except two. But at least the old students, they are from Ukraine. That's how this whole master course started, and we're trying to cooperate now also with the Kiev Polytechnical Institute. So there's
it's
a long
institute,
So it's a long history in this course, which I'm trying to learn more about. It's completely new to me still, a lot of this culture. But also, that's a good thing about science, is it's much easier to talk about science than anything else. But and there are some old divisions. I know that in the Ukraine used to be a very big part of the whole Soviet Union, for instance, defense manufacturing facilities were there. You still have transport planes, I think. Produced or it's not running very well.
Almost all of this is distracted.
It's very difficult to survive. And if you don't cooperate, then the business becomes very disruptive.
It's not about surviving business, it's about political, people who rule the country.
If you can't cooperate, Trump in the United States also, he more or less goes to war with everyone. He's just to get his own way. So it's challenging times, and it's bad for business and these things, at least on the short term. And hopefully, maybe things will work out.
Well, some people make money on that, right?
Some people, probably, yeah. That's a good question. So, the war industry is also big at Airbus. It's the biggest manufacturing facility at Airbus. It's normal, making ammunition and rockets for. Also defense.
Mm. Ammunition and the ammo this company from Airbus to in the global or only to
it's
normal?
A global scale, For instance to Saudi Arabia also.
They don't care who's got a bomb, as long as they sell more ammo, it's fine.
It's not politically correct to say this, it's not but that's
business.
It's very difficult to sell something kind of ammunition and keep full control.
Is there laws to it?
There are a lot of laws.
They also make like warheads and stuff,
and the
bigger bombs.
Typically, the more complex, the
they
weapon.
Are very strict about who they sell to, but they can't have control over what the dollar are sold.
Yeah, because those who buy them, buy weapons after the size of pigs that
it's complicated and it's politics. But it's an ethical issue at the end. So I know many engineers, former colleagues, who refuse to work for anything defense related. But it's that's the best maybe ethical position to really have a stand. It's an anti-war decision, but it's a financial question at the end also.
And
also it's the sometimes it's the most interesting technology. The most interesting material. So then, as an engineer, you're in between. It's difficult.
So much resources wasted.
And it's also been, but it's also driven so many innovations. It's hard to say. It's best that the weapons are not used at least. And that's usually the argument that's mostly made. Namo is actually a Finnish-Norwegian joint company, I think, originally.
Yeah.
And both Finland and Norway.
We also have our
own
affair.
So you try to have enough weapons so nobody
always
attacks
what is
you.
Always
that's,
in trouble.
That's the simple argument. But it's, it's tricky.
Technically, if the weapon would be not used, the company would
fail.
How long should this presentation?
15 minutes, I think, is enough. But it's not very strict. So it's as I guess you kind of got the idea from writing the paper on scientific methodology also, it's much more difficult to write 10 pages than 15 if you try to cover the same subject.
So you want to have it in papers or
I prefer
in
PowerPoint actually,
yeah.
That's
so
the easiest. And make with sounds, that's the easiest. But if you can record something or maybe make a cartoon, that's fine also. Just be creative if you want. But so it's up to you guys, but you can make your own way, just feel free. It's the whole thing is just to read the chapters and at least start thinking about these things and get an overview. And yeah, it's not very complex, but some of the things are, like I said, it's not obvious that he's talking about stuff that it's kind of a very that was a bad choice of words again. It's almost like he's not writing. It's more like he's talking about stuff. And the whole style is very it's an oral kind of presentation style. And he's an engineer, an IT engineer, so he knows a lot about some things, but he's kind of also more, he makes a few assumptions that are not really correct, and some of the technologies are not exactly well presented either, so that's a challenge. And all, that's also why I tried to give you some extra lecture notes. So
that's the
additional
content.
The additional content is, for instance, my introductions to the module content, so the slides that I've shown you and videos that I share with you and papers that are shared, those things will help you understand the content better. So Gilchrist really needs help to get extra content. He did this on his own, more or less, but he's used a couple of things that are not very well known yet, so that's why this book is good. So, for instance, the reference architecture of the industrial internet. That's, still, I'm not aware of a book that really presents this in a better way yet, so that's why we want to use it still.
Is it limited by amount of slides?
No, but it's recommended not to have more slides than you can reasonably show in 15 minutes. So 25 pictures a second is a movie. That's too much. Yeah. But usually, if Ben, I think, could be extra frame for
hidden one.
Yeah, I think so. I guess it depends for what kind of equipment you use. But my rule of thumb is to have about one slide for each minute. That's
mm-hmm.
a good starting point. And then just try to make it fit. I didn't say that last time, and then we spent an hour presenting this first part. And it became a good discussion, but it was just too long, too many slides. And it's better to have a discussion going than to spend a lot of time making the actual presentation. That's the main point. It's difficult, but it's just starting. It's just trying to get you started reading the book and discussing things. Okay.
But that should be presented next week.
Yes. And then I will show you how to share it, or you can send it to me afterwards through email or through the Blackboard. So everyone can see it. Also the off. Campus students.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if we present it in this form, then it's probably will be recorded anyway. So it's just kind of it's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know yet if the Omnum system is recording sounds, or if the sound is okay. I should have
been walking around with this microphone.
They told me, but I don't know if that works. Okay, but I think we're
more or less through with the lecture part here. Just a bit more of the background.
From the earlier part on strategy, so this is another example of the socio-technical social science kind of view of making these kind of models to help you get a concept of the or to get a feeling of the thinking behind it, but you have to read the text to understand the background. But this whole, these things, like the goal-seeking strategy formulation, or the issue-based problem-solving, those you can understand from this top, I mean the top-down or the bottom-up perspectives of solving technical problems, or if it's about deciding where the business is going to go in 5 years. Are you going to make cars, or are you going to make motorcycles? This is a major strategy decision, for instance. Are you going to make autonomous electric cars like Tesla? That's the main strategy of Tesla. And how do you do this? That was decided many years ago, and it's still happening as we speak. And now everyone is thinking, all the car manufacturers, are we going to make electric cars or not? Or are we going to be in business in 5 years? These are big questions. And it's much more about those things, this goal seeking, than the actual using the industrial internet for making the tools or the cars, the car parts. But everything is happening at once, so yeah, a lot of stuff is going on. So if a strategy is business driven, or if it's technology driven, those are the kind of issues that make the divide. And things are never 100%. And that's also part of this course, or the part of your maturing, is that you'll understand more about the whole system involved. And that's more typical now than it used to be. It used to be much more divided. And if you get the role in a company, you tend to be mostly occupied with this, whatever you're working on, and not necessarily worrying about something else, which is also related, but it's not your field. And that's the old way of working. But this experts in teamwork, for instance, is a very good way of learning this teamwork thing, which is not obvious before you start. But at least in the schools in Norway, even in kindergarten you start doing teamwork things. I don't know how that's done in Russia or in the Ukraine now. It's not so much teamwork, I think.
There is no teamwork.
I think it's mostly at the university still the professor has a big audience and you don't really do much this discussion. It's difficult if you have 200 students also, so this is, these are different ways of relating, but also, if the management or director is in charge of 10,000 people and you only see him maybe on the television, it's difficult to know what the director really is as a person, but it also makes it difficult for you as a worker to relate to this director. You don't really want to work extra hard to make extra money for this director, for instance. That's another challenge. But if the director really makes it your problem and it's up to you to earn the money and you get credit for what you do, that's much better. So a typical business model in the Western startup companies, at least, is that the actual people developing new technology, for instance, they have a stake in the earnings also. They had a stake in the company. It's quite common to have shares for every worker in a company, for instance, now. But then you accept a lower salary for increased shares. It's a risk. But then you invest more of your own time also. But then how do you have enough time for your family? And there are a lot of issues. Work hard, but also party hard. And remember to don't burn out. Those are interesting, very important things.
Minor detail.
Yeah.
Don't burn out.
It's easy. So these are points of interest. I won't go into that. These are available on the Blackboard. But there is this theory
from a guy called Akoff in 1989. And just giving you some more background about this, what is the difference between data and knowledge and wisdom? This is what his paper was about back then. So again, this remember this Lee 5C architecture that I showed last time, maybe? The triangle showing the hierarchy of the industrial or the cyber physical system, which is being constructed or architected right now as a part of Industry 4.0. It's about going from data through information and knowledge all the way up to this cognitive wisdom level, and that's kind of the vision of Industry 4.0 and artificial intelligence, is to make systems that help you make the good decisions with the best available data and models available. That's the whole idea. But how to do it is quite complex. You're still going to need people who have most of the knowledge and most of the wisdom. It's not going to be replaced by machine anytime soon, I don't think. But the data is certainly nice to be... it's good that machines or sensors are collecting the data instead of the old-fashioned manual way. Especially if you have to collect thousands of data points every day. In the old days, you did this manually, and then had to use control charts, for instance, and try to read off stuff from sensors on the equipment. But there's more of it's taken for granted now that everything is automated on the data collection part. At least that's what we all want. But then you have to know that information is not the same as data, and that's one of the big divides in the internet also. Almost everyone is talking about just collecting data and worry about how you use the data later. That's another ethical issue, especially on personal data. You know, in Norway and other places, this is a big deal thing. GDPR regulations in the European Union now controls where and how you collect data and how you store it on people. So this makes the whole, for instance, information system more complex also, and suddenly you can't share information without handling these things. But wisdom is a nice word, difficult ability to increase efficiency to add value. This is the manufacturing definition of wisdom, I'd say. That's the Yoda in Star Wars. So, this is probably what inspired the 5C architecture. This is from the Wikipedia page of Akoff. So, going from data all the way to wisdom, this triangle hierarchy, it's still... That's a nice vision, or a nice strategy to have. So, this figure that Christian showed last year, or a couple years ago, this... Okay, so the data, the signals... The know-nothing part, just raw data, given in context, becomes useful information. So if you know where the temperature or the force was recorded, then you know much more than just the number. It's data without context is usually just meaningless, especially if you don't keep track of it. Okay, so given meaning, the information becomes knowledge. And given insight, knowledge may become wisdom, so really understanding integrated and actionable information. And given a purpose, this wisdom will help guide decisions. So it's a complex process of going from data to the right decision. Yeah?
Isn't metadata? Isn't that data about data?
Yeah, that's right. So metadata.
Metadata.
Yeah. So for instance, not just the actual force recording, but also what tool, where the sensor was placed, and what time the sensor made the recording, those things are metadata. And that helps, that's actually the data in context. Yeah. And that's a very important part of data gathering, but also modeling. of data. Okay. Strategy as a plan. These points are still viable, I think. Well, strategy, is it a plan and or just a change resulting in a new plan? Those things are being discussed all the time. Stability versus change, which is a critical thing in quality control, for instance. For any kind of quality control, you need statistics and stable processes. But in order to learn something, you have to go outside maybe the stable regime of the tool and do experiments. And that kind of works against stability. And that was one of our biggest challenges at SINTEF in the lab where I worked also, that we did both research and production on the same tools. That's a big challenge. Because then you want to optimize stability for a production tool, but you want to do new stuff in research. And that's a difficult balance. On this point, knowledge is variable. That's, I think, going to be even more true now. So the knowledge that you gain now is only usable or valid in a few years. So then you have to learn new stuff, and that's what everyone's doing. So a static plan is how to balance emergent change and deliberate change. Yeah, and that's what strategy is about. The balance of change versus improvement, for instance, or stability. And since everything is changing anyway, you can never really have a static plan and expect it to work. But people come and go, and people change, and technology changes, so you have to have a way of handling these changes. That's what strategy is. And for instance, IT architecture, maybe the most important thing with an architected technology is that you understand the systems and subsystems, so it makes it much easier to change it and reconfigure, for instance, and decide if you want to build your own module or buy it from someone else, these things. But if you don't have an architecture, it's very difficult to maintain a plan, especially in IT. And security, for instance, is critical thing. IT security is maybe the biggest issue in these days. And maybe the most difficult thing with connecting machines to the internet, as I mentioned last time also. That's something you have to sort out first.
But also just change as we go. And that's, I think that was the last slide. So, Carolina, are you still with us? Maybe. Yeah. The sound was not perfect. Sorry.
But any questions before we round off at least the presentation part?
Maybe I should... So this is course curriculum.
I guess that's the most important part. There's a table with a few other papers also. And I think we'll keep the same papers as the nice to know and the need to read parts. But there may be a few changes. So, yeah, go ahead and read when you have time now. It's going to get more and more busy, I think, in the next few weeks. So you'll be starting this sustainability assessment course also next week, or is it this week? It's on Thursday. Yeah. So that's also going to be extra work. I think it's good to wait with the zero defect manufacturing that way also, so then you can hopefully we'll be we have a good plan by then in 2 weeks. It's a very it's an expensive and thick book, so that's a problem. It's a good book in this zero defect. In this course with Gilchrist we have a very cheap and easily accessible book, but in the zero defect manufacturing the book is a bit difficult to come by, but that's why we have to show a few slides just to give you the main points. But if you want to buy it, you should hurry actually and get it in order. And it's a paperback, so the combination of a thick paperback book is not good for buying used, you know. In Zero Defect, it's on the Blackboard now also.
But it's not
I'm not sure, because it's so thick and expensive that I don't know if they bought too many of them.
Expensive? How much?
Well, it's not really bad, but it's
like a
car.
Like
$1,000
crore. Yeah.
Like
and some of the copies are $1,000 equivalent. So $100 upwards.
Yeah.
So I know nothing about this.
But
I'm used to the finer things in
life. These two books are both in this course, or are these two books?
Mm-hmm. Okay, do we need the
this they have
one version? Because we found an older version of that book, the orange one.
Yeah, this is there's an older version of it on the available on the internet. Someone,
that
copied it. It's not the same. Actually, there are some changes, but you can read that also. It's still relevant. But it's not. It's actually it won't. There are a couple of changes between chapters and things that makes it difficult.
Hmm.
But
okay.
you can start with that free one and see if it links up. But anyway, we'll do this book at the end of the course.
Great.
So that's the main difference from the previous versions of this Industry 4.0 is that strategy was all about just the human-centric part without any technology almost in the course. So now it's the other way around. So we start going through technologies and possibilities and then discuss more on the strategy part at the end, the more soft side of the strategy.
Isn't that a bit weird that we had, last semester we had management, manufacturing management, which was all about basically the human side of also Industry 4.0.
Yeah.
My, like, hearing this, to me it sounds really logical to do this course first and then you follow up.
I agree.
Management.
So this management part is actually not going to be a part of MSUMA 2.0. So we have to include the management in the other courses somehow.
No. Yeah, I know there's like some kind of transition.
Yeah, because now it's been kind of the opposite around. So the technology courses have been for the last semester, and the kind of general knowledge has been for the first part. But it's now it's going to be the other way around, or actually both. So, so less management all around. Hopefully we can get you through the main parts of the management also, and this course is the part of it, and scientific methodology is also still relevant, still going to be the soft part. I mentioned also on the Blackboard that we need a student or two to volunteer to be. Remember that when I did my lecture in end of November, Carolina he had to sign a paper afterwards saying that I did okay. And now Carla and Alexander are also giving a similar kind of lecture on next